Assistant Joanna Schrader reporting for DomesticFuel.com, and I'm at the National Biodiesel Board Conference, and I have been hanging out for the last half hour, actually, and having a blast with a whole group of students who are members of the Next Generation Scientists. And I'm with one right now, James Anderson, who is with Southern Illinois University and Illinois. And James is a first-year PhD student, correct, James?
Yes.
Where did you do your undergrad work?
I did my undergrad and my master's both at Southern Illinois.
Okay, so that has to say something for Southern Illinois, because obviously they have a great program. At what point, James, when you were in college and getting your master's, did you get into the biodiesel and the biofuel sector?
Actually, my interest in biodiesel started when I used to drive trucks for a living, and whenever they started switching over to biodiesel in Illinois, there was a lot of issues with the fuel filters and stuff like that, and I thought nothing of it at the time because I was just a worker. And then when I got to Southern Illinois and I got to my PhD, I thought, you know, I need to find a project that interests me. And I remembered that back from when I was working and thought, hey, that would be a very interesting thing to apply towards what I was doing specifically in plant breeding.
So let's talk about the plant breeding. So you're focused on soybean. And, you know, it's my understanding that here in the U.S. that the primary biodiesel is still produced from soybeans and soybean oil. So what is your particular project focused on? Can you walk us through it a little bit?
My project basically is I create mutant soybean lines. I take a large pool of, we're using four soybeans, but you can literally do anyone's. I apply a mutagenesis to it, which is we're using EMS, ethyl methanol sulfonate. What it does is it takes the DNA and does point mutations on the genome. And what this does is cause random mutations on soybeans. So I take the 6,000 soybeans as our pool and plant them. Half of them will die, straight up. So, but you take that and then grow them till seed, collect the seed, and grow them again. And you just have continuing degradation because of the fact that they're mutants. Then you take those and then you run the test, the phenotypical test. You're looking at oil, protein, and the individual acid compositions within the soybean. And you look at see how much of it has changed. You know, I'm looking at biodiesel, so I'm looking at, like, stearic acid is a very important one. So I'm seeing which lines produce higher stearic acid. And from that, you take it and you create what's called a recombinant inbred line, which is you breed the soybean with itself. Soybeans do that pretty easy. It's just not a big deal. And by the sixth generation, your genetic code should be pretty much the same. And then look and see if there's any change in the genetics and of the gels to see if you can isolate where the change has happened. And then breed that into elite cultivars. So hopefully what happens is you have something that produces a large amount of stearic acid compared to normal, and then you can breed it into something that produces a large amount of oil or whatever you're interested in.
So, James, I want to talk about the breeding component. So when you talk about a mutant, obviously most people, I believe, would say, okay, so you didn't genetically cause that soybean to change. It changed on its own, correct? Or when you're defining mutant, help us kind of visualize what you mean by mutant.
A mutant is literally any change in the genetic code of an individual, of anything, will cause a mutation. It happens all the time in the human genome. Your DNA changes over time. It causes mutations. The only thing I'm doing is I'm applying an external chemical to it to induce it. So I'm not actually changing, going in and individually changing it. It's the chemical is just doing it at random.
So when the chemical does it at random, and you're saying you're testing these different mutations per se, and you're testing specifically like the acid,
yes,
that you said is very important, and then you go in and do what people think of as the genetic hybrid, or what's the next step again?
Well, it really depends. If at the end of it, if it's a stable mutation, you don't have to do genetics. You can just do standard breeding to turn it into an elite cultivar. If it's an unstable one, then you have to use molecular techniques, which is an option, and basically take the DNA section and splice it into another line. So you could do both methods. Just depends on if you have a stable or unstable one.
So, James, what's your next step? So you've kind of gotten through this first phase. You said you've planted 6,000, you know, three are going to die.
Over 1,500 or so.
So what's your next phase of this?
It's usually what happens at this point is you take the seeds and you send it to a winter nursery. So we'll send it to Puerto Rico, for instance, and then you create the inbred line so that you can, in a year and a half, 2 years, you can have the seeds back and plant them in the field for phenotypical traits.
So what are you you're seeing so far? So obviously this is going to be less expensive, correct? Because if you can get a higher acid content and conversion, is that correct?
Yes, and you could also do stuff that you normally couldn't do in normal classical breeding techniques. That's the important thing. It's not the fact that you get big increases. You get increases that are impossible other ways.
So this is really a huge breakthrough.
It's a common technique, or not so common, but it is a technique that's been used, but it has the ability to cause very big changes that are impossible other ways, quite honestly.
So James, how many years then when you continue the research? I know you said you're in your first year PhD, so you're looking at three to four more years?
We should be able to do about 2.5 to 3 years, and I should be able to have enough, because I'll be continuing to write the results as they come up. So literally the last summer I should be able to get the last data and run a lot of screens like mad and be getting out hopefully in 2015.
So James, you know, you look at PhD students, and I know obviously you're talented at this work and you're probably at home in a lab. So when you finish with your PhD, would you like to stay in a university environment, or you think you want to go more into the private sector and do the same type of genetic breeding, or what do you think?
I'm actually unsure. I want to go up to a place where I'm allowed to do what I enjoy doing, quite honestly. Whether that's a university or in a company is irregardless. But as long as I enjoy my work, that's all that's really important.
So, James, what advice do you have for the 18, 19-year-olds who are still trying to figure out what they want to do? I mean, it seems like you're having a lot of fun with this. You know, do you think some of these other kids should try this out and see what it's all about?
To me, you should always do what you enjoy. I'm doing what I enjoy. It works for me. If you're into science, play around with different major or different topics and find out what interests you, and then go with it. Don't look at the pay. That's the number one thing. My wife didn't know what she wanted to do. She really likes anthropology. I said, go into it. It doesn't matter what it is. If you enjoy it, it's not work. It's fun.
Well, that's actually, James, that's really great advice. So I want to wish you luck, and I'm hoping maybe I can see you in a year or so. Or if you have anything great breakthroughs, I always like to want to, you know, blow it on domestic fuel, you know,
yeah.
Get it out. So, you know, keep in touch with us and let us know how it's going.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thanks.
Thank you.